Well, I sort of come from a long line of adventurers. And in the late 70s, early 80s, my dad and mom went north to Alaska. I don't even know, you know, how that came about. I think just looking for something different.
Uh-huh.
And they fell in love with the Kenai Peninsula up there, which is just sort of breathtakingly, spectacularly beautiful. And they met a homesteading family that had been living there for quite a while. And the two families kind of came together and began building what would become our family business, the Great Alaska Adventure Lodge, which is a sport fishing lodge.
Wow.
And so now three generations of my family have worked there. And we go up, my husband and I now go up every other summer at least, and sometimes more often.
Oh, fantastic. Now, you live in the, do you live in the Pacific Northwest?
I do, in Seattle.
Okay, so how long does it take to get to your parents' place from where you live?
Well, let's see, there's the, I think, a 4.5 hour flight up to Alaska. And then I think there, it's either like a 2 hour drive or a 45 minute flight. I usually take the 45 minute flight.
Yeah.
You can either fly and float plane directly in front of the lodge, or you can fly into the small local Kenai airport that's near them.
Okay, that sounds fantastic. Are there a lot of homesteaders living around them still?
There are still a lot of homesteaders in Alaska. And what's interesting, you know, and I found particularly interesting in writing the book, was there was homesteading going on in Alaska until the mid-70s.
Mm.
And so, you know, most of us, when we think of pioneers and homesteaders, we think of 100 years ago and, you know, Oregon and people coming west on covered wagons. But it's really sort of the same kind of mindset, the same kind of people who are willing to sort of strike out for a dream of a different life and are willing to pay the incredible price that it takes to live off the grid and in a place where you're one of the first.
It was really incredible to read the detail in your book. You know, you kind of have a sense of how hard it would be, but the detail in the book is really, it brings it right there. Now, your own story, The Great Alone, involves Lenny and her mom, Cora, and then Lenny's dad, and they all move to Alaska because he's got this dream. So from the beginning in The Great Alone, Lenny and her mom, Cora's rapport is really well established. I love their closeness and the singing. You know, they sing Carole King songs together, excuse me, and they spend time, and they've spent a lot of time alone together when he was away at war. And I think that being victims together bonds people, sadly, and there's a theme of domestic violence in this book. I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about developing this relationship, Lenny and her mom, Cora, and figuring out who they were going to be in the book.
Well, you know, I feel in a way like at the core of this novel, I mean, yes, it's a coming-of-age story for Lenny, who's, you know, who begins at 14, but it's also very much a mother-daughter love story.
Yeah.
And it's about these two women who are sort of charged with taking care of each other. You know, for years, the father/husband is, you know, a prisoner of war in Vietnam, and he's gone. And so these two make their lives together. And then when he comes home, he is suffering from undiagnosed PTSD. And so he is somewhat dangerous and volatile. And once again, these two women bond together to care for each other and love and protect each other.
Right.
And I think that, you know, ironically, they were the ones who didn't want to go to Alaska, but both of them, particularly Lenny, really flowered there and really, you know, became a stronger woman because of it. And I think these two women just, you know, have a very deep family bond.
Yeah. I loved that they loved Alaska. You know, there's a lot of anticipation about how it's going to be when they get there. And Lenny's dad, Ernst, is really the one with the kind of manic passion about going and living off the grid and getting away from all this, you know, chaos of society. And but once they get there, as you say, they really sort of settle into it. There's a lot of hard work in getting established, but they enjoy that work. And I really appreciated that. I was so excited when she made a friend in school.
I know, because she hadn't had one, because even before Alaska, she'd been moving around a lot because of, you know, her dad had difficulty keeping a job. So it did mean a lot to all of them, because I think Cora made her first, you know, real friends up there. And one thing about living off the grid in Alaska, or anywhere, I suppose, you know, you really need a community around you to help out, to get everything done before the dark and cold of winter comes.
Right. Now that's a big theme in the book, and I'm sure it is for anybody who lives there too. Endless daylight in summer practically, and endless darkness in winter practically. So the reality of this is just extraordinary to read about. Do you know what people use for coping mechanisms? I assume there's a lot of those lights that help you emulate daylight.
You know, it's interesting. I think it's one of those things where if you can't handle it, you don't stay. You know, I mean, I think it really sort of culls the herd up there. You know, a lot of people come to Alaska and stay for that first summer.
Okay.
But it's that first winter that really begins to sort of cull the herd, and I think you decide right then, you know, if this is something that you can live with. I know even in Seattle, we have an awful lot of people who move in because summer is beautiful. But once the rains start coming day after day after day, a lot of people decide, you know, it's not for them.
Yeah, well, it's similar here. We're in Burlington, Vermont, and my husband has commented to me more than once that, you know, when we're complaining at the end of a long winter, it's like, but think how crowded it would be if we didn't have these long, dark, cold winters.
That's right. These are the coping mechanisms that we come up with.
Exactly. Right. I wondered if you could speak to your research, and I wondered if you could maybe tell us what were your best research vehicles for some of your themes. You have themes of Vietnam, PTSD, obviously Alaska, you knew something about, domestic violence. So were there any research vehicles that were surprisingly helpful or that you, you know, found in the process?
You know, actually, my very best resource were my friends in Alaska who mm-hmm. come from homesteader families who grew up during the 70s and 80s. And so, you know, had these memories exactly. And both of the two that I use really a lot grew up in exactly the area that I set the book. And so that was a huge resource. And as far as, you know, like the 70s and Vietnam and that part of the research, I came of age during that time period. And so it was very, it really formed me, that whole Vietnam War. You know, I wore one of those POW bracelets for a friend's father who was missing in action mm-hmm. and in fact, you know, didn't come home. And a lot of my friends' dads were at war or coming back from war or didn't come back from war. And so I think it's been sort of rooted in my consciousness for a long time. And I've been researching PTSD for years because I've done a couple of books about it. And mm-hmm. I just feel really strongly that, you know, sort of we as a society need to look at this very closely and, you know, make sure that we are doing everything we can for the men and women who fight for us.
Yeah. In early days of having this book out, are you finding a lot of people wanting to talk about Vietnam? It's funny, it's not the war that's top of mind anymore, but it was so prevalent in our culture for so long. It was the one.
You know, it is. It's really interesting. And of course, unbeknownst to me or whatever, you know, I'm writing this book and it's coming out very near to Ken Burns' Vietnam documentary.
Right.
And I'm seeing sort of a resurgence in, you know, sort of interest in the 70s. And I don't know what caused that. I know that for me, what made me want to set the book there was not only the homesteading in Alaska, but also the political and social mm-hmm. unrest of the era. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some, I guess, some parallels to today in terms of, you know, how divided the country is and how scary the world feels. You know, people forget that in the 70s there were, you know, terrorism bombings, hijackings, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. You know, there was a lot of turbulence in that time period. And I think it just sort of parallels today in some ways.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the storyline in the book that deals with domestic violence. I was really aware of, I just felt like you did such a good job of portraying Lenny and Cora as victims of domestic violence. They are always on edge. They are always watching Ernt and being prepared to intervene or ratchet down the tension. And this was so well done and very simply put out there. But there's a moment early in their time in Alaska where a man who becomes an important character offers advice and help to Lenny's dad. And he's not grateful so much as like angry and a bit competitive, but he has to be polite. So this line really struck me. Lenny heard something in Dad's thanks that put her on alert. He sounded irritated all of a sudden, offended. Mama heard it too. She glanced worriedly at him. So it's just like this very simple statement of what's happening. And yet I just knew deep down inside how that would feel. You know, you're just constantly, every little word, you know, because you have to defend yourself. You have to be ready. Is that something that you were constantly working on and aware of as you wrote their interactions?
Well, absolutely. You know, it was something that I wanted to tackle. You know, I wanted to talk about, you know, this issue of what it's like for women in this situation, especially historically when, you know, in the 70s there were even fewer options and even less help. And then, you know, on top of all of that, they're completely off the grid.
Right.
There's no police. There's no neighbors. There's no one to call if you need help. And so I was really, you know, I guess sort of wanting to just bring that issue into the forefront. And it's interesting how it kind of, you know, it feels like an issue of the moment with Me Too and, you know,
yes.
like just people are saying we need to bring these issues out in the open and we need to talk about them. And it was important for me that while I was maneuvering my way through this as a writer, I was also really cognizant of wanting this to be a story about triumphing over the dangers that one faces and, you know, learning to survive even in as precarious a situation as they were in.
Yeah. And I was aware as I read the book that a lot of the characters that are surviving are women. And that was a theme that I really appreciated and enjoyed, you know, it's like the strength of women against adversity of various kinds. You mentioned the Me Too movement. I think it's interesting that more than once, like in this interview today, but also recently, the fact came up that a woman in the mid-70s couldn't get a credit card without the permission of a male family member.
Yeah, a woman with a job, and it was interesting. I actually sort of included some facts like that in the book because in talking to my millennial daughter-in-law and my son's millennial friends, I sort of realized that, you know, some of this history hasn't been talked about enough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you forget how recently it was that women were, you know, treated in this way.
Yeah, it's good that that's being talked about now. I feel like there was a little flurry of anti-feminist activity among young female millennials a number of years ago, and I found that personally really disturbing. It was just, it just seemed uninformed, if nothing else.
It was exactly when I was writing the book, may I say.
Oh, really? How ironic. How coincidental.
Yes.
This is a tiny thing, but if you grew up in the era of if you came of age during Vietnam, we're probably around the same age, and maybe you'll appreciate that I loved that the one thing Cora can do is make coffee. You remember Cora in those commercials
Yes.
for coffee? That was awesome. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the depiction of the amount of work that goes into being ready for an Alaskan winter, living off the grid, that the details that you go into of all of their work of preparing a garden and a smokehouse and getting the land ready and making sure you have enough food and making sure you know how to shoot a gun and having guns handy and never leaving the house without a gun. It was just really daunting to think about. I kept thinking of Game of Thrones, winter is coming.
Yeah, that came out while I was writing, too, and I thought, that's great.
But, okay, so as far as the craft of writing, I think sometimes we get so obsessed with having to, like, research and know every little thing and know the right word for everything. And I loved that Lenny, when she's observing her father and one of the other characters milling boards, and she says, you know, they take the chainsaw and they put it into this cage thing. And I was like, that was perfect, because she wouldn't know what that was called. So I think my question is a little bit about, like, making sure you represent your character's narrative point of view in presenting information.
Well, that's, you know, obviously I think that's a really important thing. I mean, this book is primarily told from Lenny's point of view. And what I found interesting about that and what I liked about it was that, you know, as an adolescent narrator, you know, she's looking at the facts of her family and she doesn't really see as much of her situation herself as the reader sees. You know, we see the danger that Lenny's in, I think, before Lenny sees it. And, you know, we see how much work there is to do and how unstable Ernst is becoming and how dangerous this is going to be, I think, again, before Lenny does. And so it allows for a tension in the narrative that comes from the difference, you know, between what the viewpoint character knows and what the reader knows. And that's not something that I've done a lot of. I did it with The Nightingale, my previous book, mm-hmm. because, of course, I had, you know, two sisters in World War II France. And, you know, I was constantly dealing with the fact that the reader knows what's going to happen right. and knows the arc of this story and how dangerous this is going to become long before the characters do. And so when the characters make mistakes that we know historically are huge, but they think are small, it really brings a nice sort of tension and suspense to the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I had a question for you about The Nightingale, not specifically about it, but I wondered for listeners who are writers, what advice do you have, or what have you learned about following up a book that has met with tremendous success?
It's terrifying. That's what I can tell you. You know, I sort of, you know, went along in a career very, very nicely for 20 years writing books. And having a certain amount of comfort in the freedom not to have to ever really think about the reader beyond myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not one who writes books for readers. I write a book that I want to read and hope that, you know, others share my interest. But, you know, then came The Nightingale, and I saw how much the book meant to people, right. and it was very daunting. I did sort of have trouble following up that book. In fact, I wrote a book between The Nightingale, The Great Alone, and threw it away.
Oh, a whole book.
Because a whole book.
Oh my gosh.
Because it just, I don't know if it was a confidence issue. It certainly could have been. But it felt like it was a craft and execution. It felt like I had tried too hard to do something different, and, you know, I just couldn't make it work. And so finally, about 2 years into the process, I just had to decide to do what I do and be who I am and, you know, go back as much as I could to who I've always been, and that was the person who wrote the book for herself.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Good for you. I feel like one of the pressures that's on a writer who has a successful book is to produce, maybe for the publisher even, rather than the readers, you know, to produce on a schedule the next thing and the next thing and the next big sale, to be honest. And good for you that you, you know, really were thinking about craft and thinking about the kind of writer you want to be and not necessarily just producing the next book.
Well, and I was extremely lucky because you're right. Those, when you get to a certain place, those publisher concerns are real. I mean, I know what they invest and how hard they work to make something sell well. And I know it matters to them, you know, that they have the next book when they think they're going to have it.
Right.
So I was very lucky in two ways. I was lucky, one, because my publisher supports me, you know, to be able to do what I want to do. But I was also incredibly lucky. The Nightingale just kept selling.
Oh, good.
And so it gave me like a 2-year window where they wouldn't have brought out a new book even if I had written it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a gift from, you know, the universe. And it helped.
I bet. I think that's great. Well, so while we're talking about writing books, what are you writing now? What are you working on next? Do you know yet?
You know, one of the things, I mean, I've always written books about women, and I've written really sort of intimate, deeply emotional, complex stories about women's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned in the last couple of years with The Nightingale and now with The Great Alone is to take that interest of mine and put it against a more global societal or historical backdrop so that I can, in a small way, sort of shine light on women's durability, women's strength, women's history, women's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next book at the moment, assuming I keep going, is another story of a woman sort of learning to be indomitable against extraordinary odds, against the backdrop of history.
Okay. Okay, you don't want to tell us which history.
Nope.
Okay, that's fine. How about what you read? Do you have anything that you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners?
Well, certainly, I mean, I'm not alone in saying that my favorite book recently is Gentleman from Moscow.
Oh, yeah.
I was a little bit late in coming to the party on that one because I was writing. And so I just read it recently, and I marvel at what he was able to accomplish in that. I also love Russian history. So I thought that was really great. I also loved a thriller called Hellbent from Greg Hurwitz. I thought it was just great.
Okay, okay. And I just, like 2 days ago, finished Amor Towles' other book, The Rules of Civility. Have you read that one?
No, how was it?
Oh my God, I couldn't believe I would enjoy another book after A Gentleman in Moscow. I thought there was no way that something he wrote earlier could please me as much. It was so good. So
oh,
good.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely.
Good. Maybe I'll get that on tour. I'm on airplanes a lot in the next couple of days.
It's a great one. And it has a lot of that same sensibility, but it's not Russia. It's Manhattan in the 30s, and it's wonderful. Okay, so I just have one last question for you, Kristen. When I'm interviewing writers, I always like to finish with some craft advice, and I wondered if you can talk a little bit about what you do when and if the plot won't move forward. You know, maybe you've identified your characters, maybe you know they're going to be in Alaska, but what do you do if you get to a what happens now moment, or you feel like maybe you've gone down the wrong path?
Okay, so this happens in every single book, and it doesn't happen once with me. It happens a lot of times because I set out to write a certain kind of book. I have it in my head. I do a synopsis. I write an outline. I know the beginning, the middle, and the end. I know what I'm doing, and then I create characters, and the characters often change everything. So what usually happens is around page 100, I get to exactly the point you're talking about where I can't seem to move forward.
Okay.
And the answer is always start over. Go back to the beginning, realize what is working, cut out what isn't, and follow, you know, the story that is working, the characters that are working, because for me, I feel like my subconscious is light years ahead of my conscious mind, mm-hmm. and it's working stuff through, and I just have to be smart enough and flexible enough to follow it.
Okay.
And then let the plot and the characters evolve.
So how long does it take you to write a book? And let's not include the one that you had to throw away in the middle.
You know, nowadays, it's pretty much 2 years.
Okay.
You know, I'm a very, very fast writer, but I do a lot of drafts and a lot of editing. So, you know, I'll do probably 6 to 8 months of research and then probably, you know, 18 months of writing and rewriting, and then it goes into my editor, and then it's usually another couple of months of editing with her.
And do you write a full first draft without letting yourself change things? Or, well, obviously not if you're starting over,
no.
But when you think that you're on the right path, will you just keep pushing through, or do you edit as you go?
I edit every 100 pages. I literally start over every 100 pages. And, you know, if it's going really, really well, will I sometimes go to 200? Yes. But I know from experience that that is usually not the smartest idea. I need to pretty regularly step back and analyze, because I find the act of writing itself, first draft writing, is, to me, it's so fun. It's my favorite part, because you don't know what's wrong, so it feels great. It all feels great. And it isn't until you hold it up against some standard that you begin to see, you know, what needs to be improved. So I try to go far enough that I can get a feeling for what I'm actually doing, but not so far that I'm just spinning out of control.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's great. I want to just thank you once again for being on the show, Kristen Hanna. The book is The Great Alone, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. Kristen, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. This was really fun.